staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. We're going to welcome our calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, unless we ask for them, because we have with us tonight our good friend Bill Sardi, who's a health journalist, has a tremendous amount of information on all the issues, or so many of the issues that face us today. And, of course, nothing has really changed. You know, for years we've always been concerned about high blood pressure and the cholesterol levels. But the question is, are the concerns really justified? And how do we approach the concerns? And so with that as the background, Bill, thank you so very much for being with us again.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. And, of course, I'm just back from Europe, where I did visit Germany and the Netherlands. And it is interesting to see what they... Well, they must struggle through there. If we think we have problems with the freedom of having vitamins and minerals, supplements and so on, they really have onerous regulations and restrictions there. In France, just 60 milligrams of vitamin C, anything more than that is considered a drug. The doctors throughout all of Europe have a lock on all of this with the drug companies, so that it drives people to have to go to doctors and have to... of course, buy the drugs or whatever, get a prescription for some of these things. Just 3 micrograms of vitamin B12, anything more than that is considered a drug in Germany. There's no way you'll, well, we can buy 5,000 micrograms here in the United States, just to give you an idea. And about 40% of adults have pernicious anemia, need B12 supplements. 3 micrograms will never fix the problem. You'd need to take about 80 of those pills a day to fix the problem, or otherwise you've got to go to the doctor and get shots, which is expensive, and of course that needle isn't comfortable. And vitamin D, they just did a study in Finland and found that about 78% of men were vitamin D deficient in the winter months. In fact, all of Northern Europe is deficient in vitamin D, is particularly in those winter months, and yet all they allow is 200 micrograms in a dietary supplement, not just a trivial amount, just slightly over the amount you would need to become frankly deficient and have your bones soften and begin to bend. Otherwise, they won't give you enough to prevent cancer or help you with prostate problems or heart failure or so many of the immunity and some of the other wonderful things that vitamin D will do if you can get 2,000 to 4,000 units a day. And so those are all just rigging the deck, making it all add up so that it costs more. You have to consider it a drug. And, of course, you'd think, well, maybe there's limits on these things because, well, maybe too much would be side effects and so on, yet we have a whole population here of over 280 million people in America who are able to buy thousands of milligrams of vitamin C, 1,000 milligram capsules, and take as much as they want. They can get 5,000 unit B12 pills. They can get vitamin D and, well, up to 5,000 unit tablets, and we don't see any side effects from it. So what is the precaution that Europe is exercising? Of course, it's just to keep patients going to doctor's office and run up the bill.
Hold up. We'll be back here in just a minute, and I fear that will be happening here in America before long. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, we're really talking about how Europe and using the codex over there. This system, they're actually restricting the availability of vitamins and minerals to the general people. Unfortunately, one of the provisions in CAFTA, certainly the treaty that was recently signed under tremendous pressure from the Bush administration, it cost them $50 billion of bribes to the congressmen to get that legislation through, and they only got it through by a couple of votes. But one of the provisions there was Codex. Bill, do you think we're going to have those same sort of restrictions here in America?
Well, they have all the time in the world, and they move just like a turtle. They'll move slowly, but proceed as fast as they can when we're distracted, and they do these sometimes on July 4th on the Friday night before July 4th and everybody's away on vacation, and they'll pass some legislation through Congress that'll limit dietary supplements and so on. And right now we're living in a time when there's a great deal of negative publicity about dietary supplements. This has been going on for months now. A great deal of this is contrived or simply pseudoscience. The latest one, of course, being that glucosamine was worthless. Of course, it's interesting that glucosamine worked for the most severe form of arthritis, just not the milder forms. It's usually the other way around. And so it means it really does work, but they spun that headline around to say glucosamine doesn't work. A week earlier, they said calcium supplements don't work. We somewhat agree with that. But the problem with the study is that they conducted it on premenopausal and menopausal women. So in the premenopause, you're not losing any bone, and you don't have osteoporosis, so the study's worthless as to whether calcium supplements help anything. You didn't have the problem then. You have the problem when menopause hits and you don't have the estrogen production. You start to lose bone, and that shows you right there, obviously, the way you fix the problem is to provide an estrogen replacement, not a calcium supplement. And, of course, all we're doing is clogging women's arteries and kidneys, and that's exactly what they found, higher rates of kidney stones with calcium supplementation. But both alternative and conventional medicine have been misled on this calcium issue. And really what we've been finding lately is the calcium's all about not just making bones that are more dense, but bones that don't fracture so that we don't have hip fractures, which is considered a mortal event because eventually you'll not be able to walk and then you have pneumonia and you die, especially if you're an elderly female. So that's what we're really after. That's the end point. That's the big measuring stick. And, of course, we're not just trying to raise numbers here. So
Hold that thought right there, please. Well, this is Archie Stan, and our guest this evening is Bill Seide, and he's simply talking about the various means that we have of measuring the bone density in women. And, oh, my goodness, we got a figure here. Everything's going to be fine. We got the figure. You're high, low. But, of course, is that the real figure? Does the bone density figure determine whether or not you're going to get a hip fracture or not? And, of course, so many of the studies have shown it really isn't so much the bone density as the muscle control and the muscle power and the muscles adjacent to the joint. So pick up the story there.
Well, that's certainly right, Dr. Stan. Of course, you wish you'd have had all this information when you were in practice, but we're just now learning. Of course, vitamin D was discovered many decades ago, but we're still learning lessons from it. It's, tragic that we didn't do more study with this. That's the National Institutes of Health with misdirected research funds, but we're just now finding that vitamin D is a muscle toning hormone vitamin. That's really what it is in the body. When we make vitamin D in our skin from sun, it becomes a hormone. We can take it as a supplement. We call it a vitamin. And it does have something to do with muscle tone, as well as this has to do with heart failure because of the heart is a muscle. It has to do with incontinence, urinary incontinence, because that's muscle controlled. And, of course, here, the ability to stand up straight and not sway or fall and then, of course, get a hip fracture. So we're finding it's more related to vitamin D than it is certainly the calcium. Now we get a little distracted there because vitamin D does help us utilize calcium, so that's been the mistaken impression. But in reality, why it looks like it's just vitamin D itself, and of course we know we need a lot more than the amounts they're recommending. So, these are just lessons to learn, and of course I'm releasing on my website, knowledgeofhealth.com, a report, Health by the Numbers. We go through four of the common, numbers that we use to think that we're healthy: blood pressure, cholesterol, bone density, which we've just been talking about a little bit, and, of course, your PSA count for your prostate for the males. And, of course, just trying to tell everybody that these numbers are flawed. Your blood pressure numbers are many people calling me. They're on medications when they don't need to be because they're not, the doctor's not adjusting the numbers for their age. You're if you're 65 to 74 years of age, your blood pressure can be as high as 159 for men or 167 for women. That's the first number in your blood pressure, and you have no increased risk of stroke or heart attack. And, of course, we just need to learn this because they're putting us on these medications with the side effects too quickly. And, of course, we're pointing out that frequently people go have their blood pressure measured in the doctor's office unless they hold your arm in the correct position, which is horizontally. And at heart level, while they measure it, it'll be an invalid test. And they hold it wrong when they do your blood pressure. A blood pressure of 155 over 85 could read 180 over 96 just by holding the arm wrong. One study showed less than 8% of nurses and doctors measure blood pressure utilizing the proper arm position. Then they put you on these medications.
Well, you know, it's really very interesting. When I practiced medicine, why the blood pressure for the elderly was 100 plus your age. So if you were 50, why it would be 150. I'm talking about the systolic now. You were 60, 160. You were 70, 170. Well, you can go into the doctor now. You're 70 years old, and you have a blood pressure of 160. Which would actually be a little low by the old standards. Oh, no, we've got to get it down to 120. Everybody's got to get to 120. And really, if you read the statistics and you read the studies on this, it's not justified at all. But the drug companies have done a magnificent job of selling the doctors that you've just got to get everybody's blood pressure down to 120 or 115. And then, of course, they begin to get a minor stroke. Sometimes they get dizzy. They'll fall. One of my friends, good friend, wives got on a blood pressure medication and fell and broke her neck, and it killed her. Now, you know, what you're doing by dropping the blood pressure, you know, too far is you're really, I think, laying people open for strokes and blood and heart attacks. But everybody wants to do exactly the same thing. And I'll never forget when I was a very young doctor, and an older doctor said to me, you know, doctors are like sheep, and one goes one direction, they all go that direction. And you'll see that things go through cycles, every 10 or 20 or 30 years, those cycles replayed over and over again. And I really feel that this is in part what is going on today. Everybody says you got to get the blood pressure down to 120, which is fine, you know, maybe if you're 18 or 19 years old. But by the time you get as old as I am, I think you need a higher blood pressure, man. And the idea of trying to drop somebody's blood pressure down to 120 when it's been 160 for all of their life, I think that is just foolishness.
Well, it's not only foolishness, but so many of the patients are deceived because blood pressure, you can see the number right there on the little monitor. So you get convinced that you have a problem just by the numbers. Now, of course, for all of us, mild increase in blood pressure is a 10-year risk of stroke or heart attack. So, you know, you're not going to have something overnight unless your pressure's going way up over 300 or something. But we also find that a lot of patients are simply not aware. They may have heard this and then forgot. What we call white coat hypertension, meaning the doctor walks in with his white coat, and unconsciously your anxiety levels go up. This happens more with women than men, but the pressure is likely to rise quite a few points. And I've noticed a number of the conservative doctors, when you talk to some of the people on the phone like I do, they'll say, well, my blood pressure was up and the doctor told me to go down to the drugstore and have it checked to see if it matched what was in the office. Well, see, the doctor knows that patients get a little anxious in the office, so go down to the drugstore and let the pharmacist check it. They may have a machine down there or some other place where you're not quite as anxious and see if the number's a little lower. And then if you have continued recorded numbers where it's a little high, you can start addressing this. And the first thing to do is with the diet and exercise, certainly not these medications. Medications are rescue procedures that need to be used for people that really have a serious issue. And instead, of course, they say that patients won't practice good health measures and diet and exercise, so we just put them on the medications right away, and we know that none of them work, and most of them deplete you of essential nutrients, and they don't have even one drug that works for hypertension. They put you usually on two or three. And so this is the problem. We have health by the numbers these days. We're writing an article at knowledgeofhealth.com. Health by the numbers, And, of course, we're trying to tell you that blood pressure, well, it's flawed the way they tell us what numbers you need to be put on medication. Cholesterol, we're just going to tell you now that you may have heard this before on the program, that cholesterol seems to have nothing to do with mortality rates, as many people have a mortal heart attack with a cholesterol under 200 is over 300. And then, of course, your PSA tests for the men, they just cling to those numbers. They're scared. They submit to a biopsy because their, quote, PSA number is a lot higher. And yet doctors from Stanford University conceding the numbers don't mean anything now. They're worthless. They do not detect cancer. They only indicate inflammation. If you've had a little inflammation, even a prostatic exam, even if you're taking certain medications and so on, your PSA numbers can go up. And it has nothing to do. You can have PSA numbers as high as 25 and not have cancer. That's hard to tell men because they're told if it's over 1, then of course they need to, go for a biopsy and so on. So this is the kind of thing that's going on. Doctors at Stanford saying, even if your PSA drops by doing something and you think, boy, now I'm out of the risk, 24% of men who had an elevated PSA number and then it dropped were still found to have cancer on a biopsy. So, you know, this PSA test is not cracked up to be what they claim. Doctors use it to drum up business only. They know better. One of the articles in the Journal of National Cancer Institute pointed out that 88% of the time doctors recommend PSA testing, even though they, unlike their patients, have sufficient training to know it's not a valid test. So this is the problem. And they know it's not valid, but it's good for business.
Well, because I think the other thing is that everybody else is doing it. And you go to the meetings and you hear the doctors talking, and they're all, I mean, the leading people seem to all be going along that way, and there's such a tendency to follow whether it's valid or not.
Well, doctors at Stanford are saying, what are we to do in the face of such massive, unwarranted PSA screening? Lowering the PSA cutoff point only serves to compound the tragedy by adding millions of men to the biopsy list. Stanford doctors say little is likely to change the current state of overdiagnosis and overtreatment. This may shock a lot of men. I know they've been clinging to those PSA numbers, and of course they may be totally misleading, and you may pay a price to cling on to them because there's other things you should have been doing or watching. So we try to outline those for you, but it's just another one of these health by the numbers little games that's going on in modern medicine today and makes you think that you are, of course, healthier or actually ill and need more treatment. So bone density is one. It's a failed number. Bone density is how dense your bone looks. So if it looks like a honeycomb, that's not dense. You've lost some calcium, but there's bone flexibility, bone hardness, and it's not related to hip fracture. That's the big story.
And of course, the big thing is to get adequate vitamin D. And of course, vitamin D apparently is a sterol type of vitamin. And of course, the sterols work on the muscles. Now, this is not an androgenic sterol or steroid, but it's certainly a vitamin D actually influences muscle function, as well, of course, playing a part in other types of metabolism.
Sure.
So we're going to be back here in just a moment with Bill Sardi. But adequate doses of vitamin D are certainly very, very important for muscle function and health. And most people, especially in the northern climates, and especially if you're black, do not get adequate doses of vitamin D. And that's why supplements are so important, and they seem to be intent upon limiting our ability to get them. Well, Bill, why don't you pick up the story?
Well, certainly health by the numbers is our topic tonight, and of course we've been talking about these numbers, the PSA test for men, the bone density mostly for women, and of course we've talked about hypertension, the blood pressure numbers, and cholesterol we've talked about on previous programs, but just to underline it again, the Journal of Pharmaceutical Society of Japan calling for a needed change of direction for cholesterol-related medication, a problem of great urgency. What are they talking about? High cholesterol is not positively associated with coronary heart disease, mortality rates, among populations 40 to 50 years old, the highest risk group. And, of course, more importantly, higher total cholesterol values are associated with lower cancer and all causes of mortality rates among these populations. I said higher amounts of cholesterol. So this is a shocking story. It comes out of Japan. There are others to corroborate this, as many have a heart attack with a cholesterol under 200 is over 300. About half the patients admitted to hospitals for a heart attack have a normal cholesterol level. And, of course, cholesterol numbers can be too low. It's amazing to me how many people tell me, boy, I have a cholesterol level of 120 or so on. Boy, if it's that low, if it's below 160, the non-cardiac death rate doubles below 160, and it increases your risk of cancer and mental depression as your cholesterol numbers drop that low, and it means your liver isn't functioning properly. So you were living with high cholesterol numbers when you were a kid. You didn't have any problems then. So this health by the numbers thing, it's great for American business in the healthcare arena. It drums up business. It helps people keep coming back and checking what their numbers are. But we're no healthier. We're not living longer. Mortality rates aren't reduced. And, of course, this is a tragic thing. We now have this illusion of being healthy or possibly being sick and worrying about numbers that we shouldn't, like our blood pressure. They need to be age-adjusted, and for most of us, we can handle numbers that go quite a bit higher than what we've heard of before. We're on blood pressure medicines when we don't need to be. We're on statin cholesterol-lowering drugs when it's needless, and of course they can cause serious troubles. We're having biopsies from our prostate gland when we don't need them, and of course we're on certain medications and taking excess calcium when the bone density test doesn't look normal. Most of the bone density tests, then they tell you to take calcium, but calcium only slows down the rate of loss. You're still losing, and you're still on the minus side. They never tell you that, so you're still losing bone density. Now, it's an issue of hormone loss. It's not an issue of not enough calcium in your diet. So this is a mistaken impression that both alternative medicine and frankly, conventional medicine overlook. And, of course, they've taken the hormone replacement away from women. So we strongly suggest flaxseed meal is good. Some people want to try soy, but we love flax.
And, of course, there are really a lot of problems with soy, and I think flax is far, far safer and better.
Well, in reality, probably soy is okay, but we don't get it the way Japanese people do. They have fermented sources that are actually more concentrated than what we have here, and we think, well, there's toxic molecules in soy, I don't want more of them. No, that's the secret of the Japanese. They get more in a fermented source like miso. And
now, hold that thought right there for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Bill Sarni. And Bill was simply pointing out so much of what you have heard about the statin drugs is simply a scam. And the whole idea is statin drugs work. They work to lower your cholesterol. There's no question they do that. But the question is, do you cut down significantly on the morbidity and the mortality in the average individual? You may take a select group who've already had heart disease, and you may show that if they take the statin drugs, why they'll do better than another group, although very, very little better. The statistics show very little change. But is it because it's lowering the cholesterol? And if you really examine the situation, you know, half the people who come into the hospital with a heart attack have normal cholesterol levels. And this idea of getting your cholesterol down, what they don't tell you is you get your cholesterol down, it increases your incidence of cancer. It increases your incidence of mental problems because your brain doesn't work as well. And any of you out there who would like to verify what I'm saying, you give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. Just ask for the page out of the PDR on Crestor. Crestor is by far the most efficient cholesterol-lowering drug we have. But they will say right there for you, this does not influence cardiac morbidity or mortality, figuring if they use the big words, nobody would know what they're talking about. And they love to do that and bury it in the middle of everything. But morbidity means disease, cardiac morbidity, heart disease, cardiac mortality, dying from heart disease. and you take this medication because you don't want to die, and yet they will say quite openly, this is not going to influence that, so why are you taking it? Well, we're getting your figures down. We're getting your numbers down. I think it's one of the greatest scams of all time. And, of course, we have a great deal of material on that. We have a tape set. We've got books on it. You need to get the facts. You need to see what the studies really show. And then maybe you need to get your doctor educated, because the doctors really don't understand what we're saying. They're being told this by the... They've got to get the people, onto the statin drugs, by the detail men, by their journals, by the medical meetings they go to. And, of course, the companies send in high-paid fellows, doctors, to give speeches to get their fellow doctors to prescribe the statin drugs. And, of course, they are really wonderful for the drug companies. Pick up, destroy their bill.
Well, it's hard to believe this cholesterol story, and, of course, Journal American Medical Association showing that in regards to cholesterol reduction, why if you give statin drugs, you reduce the mortality rate by 0.4%. So it's almost meaningless. And, of course, out of people who take statin drugs, 1 out of 71 users will avoid a heart attack. Now that's 1.3%. So it's just you mean to tell me? Yes, we mean to tell you that 70 people taking statin drugs will get no benefit. One will avoid a heart attack, not a mortal heart attack. And of course, these are the numbers that are supplied to us by of course, this comes from the Medical Letter, well-known prestigious journal. So, you know, these references underscore all this. It's just there's a different level of medicine at the practice end, and doctors are being, courted by drug companies and so on, and they want to be experts and talk and get paid for being speakers and experts and all the other things. So there's perks that come along with a lot of this, and frankly, a lot of scientific literature is thrust in front of the doctor's eyes to make it look like these things are good for you. But in reality, it's just moving numbers around.
And I'll never forget when I was involved in medical politics, and suddenly I get calls from the medical association asking me to go out and give talks, and of course you'll get a nice honorarium, and you'll go over all of the state giving talks, and it'll be good for your practice, and you'll get all sorts of referrals. And it was simply a matter of bribing me to get me to be quiet. This is how the system works. Oh, the doctors, of course, will be employed by the drug companies to give the talks. And of course, they're going to say what the drug company wants them to tell the other doctors. And now they're the expert. It's great for their practice. It'll get lots of referrals because now you're known. And it's simply a way that you can control the doctors. And I'll have to admit, it was awfully hard to turn down this opportunity to take tours across the state and throughout the area. But, you know, you got to put principle ahead of profit. Else you become totally compromised. And believe me, they compromise the doctors with medical politics. They compromise them with all sorts of goodies and gifts from the drug companies, who are making billions, countless billions of dollars off the statin drugs and some of the other things that the people are really being frightened into taking. And the idea, if you don't take these drugs, you are going to die. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you do take the drugs, you're going to die. We're all going to die. But look and see what the statistics really show. We've got a great book called On Statin Drugs. We've got a great 4-tape set. You need to get the documentation. The book actually has it. And we hope maybe you'll want to get us. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Well, Bill, why don't you pick up the story there?
Well, as our report goes on tonight, we were shocked today to see a report in the British Medical Journal. This is a running story. It has been developing over time. And, of course, acetylcholine is a memory molecule in the brain called a neurotransmitter. It's your memory molecule. And there's certain medications called anticholinergic drugs. Don't let me lose you here. That interfere with the acetylcholine and can infect your memory and your mental function. It's amazing, about half of Americans at one time in their life or another take anticholinergic drugs. These are to prevent spasms of bladder spasms, sedatives, antidepressants, antihistamines, long list of them. And of course about 30% of nursing home patients are on these drugs. It turns out they did a study in Britain, and of course as they look at this, about 35% of the older adults that they tested had a little bit of mild mental impairment, but a whopping 80% did if they used this class of anticholinergic drugs. And of course then they put you on a drug that counters this and tries to promote acetylcholine. And of course this is of course absurd, to think I'm giving you one drug that causes the problem and then another one to clean it up. So I mean, this is exactly where modern medicine is. It's being pointed out in the online edition of British Medical Journal. And of course we're talking about many people in nursing homes having memory problems, name recall problems, can't recall faces, verbal problems, and so on. And of course we think they're getting senile. It's coming from the medicines we're giving them. Now there's many, many drugs, a long list. We're going to publish them at the website at knowledgeofhealth.com so you can see them. If you have loved ones in a nursing home, but there are many other people taking these outside of the nursing home. And these are, as I say, antihistamines, antidepressants, antispasmodic drugs. One of them is used for asthma, theophylline, and so on. So digoxin is one. It's used for the heart. Furosemide is Lasix. It's a diuretic, but it's another one of these ones that interferes with this memory molecule in the brain called acetylcholine. These are why I'm giving you some of the more common drugs that are prescribed and used that interfere, and this may be causing you to have memory and mental problems and so on. It affects your reflex time and so on.
Oh, hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment with Bill Soddy. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, of course, is Bill Soddy, is a health journalist, and at knowledgeofhealth.com is his website, knowledgeofhealth.com. Can you link to that from AskBillSoddy.com, or do they go together?
Yes, they do.
All right, and of course, Bill was simply pointing out that so many of the elderly people in our nursing homes will be taking anticholinergic drugs. It's something you'd take for bladder spasms, you'd take it for stomach spasms, things of that sort. It's a smooth muscle relaxer. And the anticholinergic drugs related to atropine, things of that sort. Well, anyway, of course, they found that if you were taking these anticholinergic drugs in the nursing homes, ordinarily about 30% of the people would have some memory problems. But once you were on those drugs, 80% of the people would have memory problems. So they are really affecting the entire metabolism, not only the body but the brain. And then, of course, they want to give you something else to counter the effect of the anticholinergic drugs. And so often when you take one drug, then you have to take another drug to counteract its effect. And the more drugs you take, the more you are altering your normal physiology. Now, sometimes drugs are important, but so often drugs are simply going to get you into more and more problems. And if you can possibly avoid them, you should avoid them like the plague. So with that as a background, go ahead and pick up the story, Bill.
Well, you're hearing so much here tonight, and of course we have written a book, The Collapse of Conventional Medicine. You can go to my website and get it for free. Download it and read it. We have a disease care system. We don't have a health care system here. Many, many experts have come on to Radio Liberty to tell you the same story one after another. We have a failed health care system, yet we keep putting trust in it. We keep saying, well, it's not my doctor. I love my doctor. We've had him for years. Your doctors are being deceived and misled as well, and so we want to make you aware. Maybe some things you can do to help them is print out reports and sources of information from the Vitamin D Council or elsewhere, and of course bring them into your doctors. Let them know that you've got this information that's authoritative and referenced and might put them on notice that this is the kind of medicine you want practiced. And I know we need to be judicious, and certainly we don't want to offend our doctors and so on, but we need to find a way to show them there's something a little different going on here, make them aware of some of this. And in the end, if they're not delivering this kind of wonderful medicine, the natural medicine that's available, why, maybe we need to go somewhere else. But for most of us, we need to be practicing health at home. Keep the doctor you have and run to him when you need him.
And, of course, really, there's so many great things up on Bill Sardi's webpage. And then, of course, we carry the books by Russell Blaylock. And really, once you get to know who you can begin to trust in these fields, and all the sorts of scientific literature out here is being done, but the average doctor does not have the time to read all of these publications, and they're not in the magazines that he would ordinarily be reading, and this is never brought up at the meetings he attends and never published in his journals. Why? Because so many of them carry advertisements from the drug companies, and the last thing the drug companies want is for the doctors to begin using normal healing products and normal health products and alternative products and getting away from the prescribing medicines and getting back to vitamins and minerals. And so many of the things that are out there, for instance, everybody on statin drugs, if you're going to take them, and you shouldn't be, but if you were taking them, you ought to be taking CoQ10 because it suppresses the CoQ10. And so, but the average doctor doesn't know that you give statin drugs, you create another problem. CoQ10 has a tremendous impact on muscle function, on the brain, specifically on the heart. A lot of patients, you know, get low CoQ10 because they're on statin drugs, and they get congestive heart failure. So you treat the congestive heart failure. And, you know, if you read the literature, you'll find that there's a definite relationship between statin drugs and CoQ10, but nobody is telling the doctors, you need to get the information, you need to get the documentation, and you need to get to your doctor so he can do a better job. So we've got a caller here right now. Who is calling in?
This is Ed Nighthole.
Okay, Ed, did you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I do. Recently I read in a newsletter by a well-known herbalist that a female, and she has a lot of credibility, she really downplayed the use of supplements, specifically but not limited to vitamin C.
All right. Go ahead.
Her comment on vitamin C was that any more than 250 micrograms was dangerous, and that prolonged use of high doses of vitamin C would poison the blood.
I would say that she really did not done any research at all on it, but go ahead, pick up the story on that, Bill, because certainly we do not produce vitamin C. We need vitamin C supplements, and I think anybody who puts out that material, I would not pay for a newsletter, Ed. But go ahead, Bill, what are your comments?
Well, please visit my website. We have the Vitamin C Project there. You can read all about it. We actually petitioned the Food and Nutrition Board, part of the National Institutes of Health, to raise the recommended dietary allowance for vitamin C. Latest literature shows that all of what you've read about vitamin C, that it creates expensive urine, you can't benefit from more than a couple hundred milligrams and all this, is rubbish. And, of course, they proved it themselves. It comes from the National Institutes of Health researchers, but they refuse to change the information on their websites and other sources of information. They refuse to retract previous flawed studies that we've made them aware of. So you just need to immerse yourself in this whole story. And, of course, Dr. Steve Hickey and Hillary Roberts from England making us aware in their books. You can go to my website, find out how to find them. But so you can get educated about vitamin C. And, of course, animals make thousands of milligrams of vitamin C a day. We don't. We lost the ability to do this generations ago. But they do, and of course, they don't have heart disease and aneurysms and gallbladder attacks and a whole bunch of other things. So, you know, we just lost the ability to do this, and we need to replace it with thousands of milligrams of vitamin C a day. And we need to take it through the day. And the alleged side effects of kidney stones, unproven. Probably vitamin C prevents kidney stones. DNA mutations, that's been proven false. They've tried every way to discredit vitamin C. High doses, if you just get 750 milligrams a day, we'd find the cardiovascular risk for sudden mortal heart attack would drop by 25%. So We just need to learn this information. There is misinformation in the medical literature. There are studies that are flawed. If you don't know how to read them, you'll run into them and then be confused. So we try to uncover these things, get you educated, make you aware of how to, understand the truth from the fiction, and therefore you'll be better armed in weighing this argument out, and of course being able to utilize vitamin C for your own health.
And Ed, I think you have to determine whether this woman you're reading is telling the truth or Bill is telling the truth. But I will tell you that we have people working at the highest echelons of the healthcare industry for government who are doing everything they can to be harmful to the American people. One example would be the water fluoridation program, which the 11 unions that represent the EPA, employs the scientists, the lawyers, the engineers who work for the EPA, have all petitioned the EPA to immediately stop water fluoridation. And it's advocated by the CDC and by the Public Health Service. Why would they advocate something that is harmful to the American people? Well, all I can say is the CDC has been in charge of our health. 500,000 people have died of AIDS. Another 1 million people are infected and they're going to die. Is that a successful public health policy or a successful genocidal policy? There are 60 million Americans with a sexually transmitted viral disease. Thanks to the public health policy that says, gee, all you have to do is just go ahead and be promiscuous, but use some protection. Do you really want to trust those people with your life, Ed?
No, I do get Bill's newsletter, and I appreciate it. It's just that I came across this information. I don't subscribe to this gal's newsletter, but I came across this information. I thought, how odd coming from a herbalist.
Right. Well, sometimes people just don't know. Maybe you need to try to get her educated. Try to get her to take Bill's newsletter, too, okay?
Okay.
God bless. Thanks for calling, Ed.
Thank you.
And, of course, there are a lot of good people out there. And, of course, Bill, I know that your newsletter is reaching a lot of people. How can people get your newsletter?
It's free, and you just go to knowledgeofhealth.com, leave your email address, sign up there, and you get it sent free. There's no obligations. You won't receive advertising. You have complete privacy of your name, and you're on the list, and so on. It's just all for you. And, you know, we're dedicated to getting good information to people to stay healthy. To the point of distraction, with my own wife, we spend $50,000 a year to deliver this. And, this is a commitment of ours to try to get information at very low cost to people. There are a few e-books for sale there because some people want to read a book or would like to buy a book and hardbound and have it to read at home. But all the proceeds of that goes to my web manager and to the people that manage the site and to advertise it so that people will come. And, of course, it's just completely a public service. So with that said, people can come there confidently and know there's no commercial interest being pushed. We're trying to be there for you. And whether we're talking about sudden infant death syndrome or autism or blood pressure or vitamin D or whatever the stories are, we have a current story on the website now. The man who cured heart disease with a natural molecule 20 years before cholesterol drugs, this is all about Lester Morrison. We show you the cover of his book and the of course, striking pictures from the inside of his book showing that chondroitin sulfate, a dietary supplement, you can get it at the health food stores, used many years ago in the 1970s, completely cured heart disease and certainly helped people after heart attacks. Rebuilt the heart, took the arteries and cleaned them out, and all they did was give this. We give a couple of the case presentations there of people that were certainly on 7 or 8 medications and on oxygen tank kind of thing and so on, and within just 3 months or 4 months on chondroitin sulfate therapy only, they were out walking or running 5 or 6 miles a day. They were down to one of the medications or almost none, and of course they had renewed their cardiovascular system. See the story for yourself. We uncovered it. It's authoritatively told. It was by the way, we list all the references. Dr. Morrison was in 8 peer-reviewed different studies that were published on the National Library of Medicine, and yet modern medicine ignores his finding that a simple dietary supplement would heal the heart and blood vessels, clean up the plaque, This is part of the vitamin C story because it goes along with it. And, of course, we're urging you to come to the website and take a look for yourself at these pictures that we share to you from Dr. Morrison's book. They're a tremendous lesson for all of us as to we can reverse cardiovascular disease as we know it. He did his studies with animals and then on into humans, lowered the risk of having a mortal heart attack by 350%. Modern medicine ignored what he discovered, and of course the results were tremendous. So these are some of the things that we love to share with you at the website. Of course, we have a lot of information about the bird flu, and we tell you all about that. I was interested while I was writing these articles from Europe, both on the Dr. Morrison's discoveries and so on, but we shared one on malaria, and of course I was a little bit amused, Dr. Stan, because I know you've shared many times that DDT is something that's harmless and can be used in a beneficial way. You've talked about a man who actually swallowed DDT in front of an audience to show people how harmless it was, and yet we have so many people dying of malaria in the world, and how, you know, just spraying a little DDT in minor amounts on the walls of homes, why, you'd deter the little bugs, the little insects that carry the malaria, and then, of course, you'd cut down these malaria outbreaks. So, you know, some of the answers in the world are simple. They wouldn't cost a lot of money, and this is another one. So sometimes we deal with world health issues there, but we try to deal with your personal health issues. What you should be doing, certainly we have to debunk conventional medicine in order to carry you away from what you're clinging to out of fear. You're afraid to get off your medications that are just causing you to be chronically ill and so on. So we try to give you the information so you can see some of the flaws of modern medicine and then give you some alternatives, things you can try on your own that will get you well and certainly don't cost a lot of money. And these, of course, are usually the dietary supplements. As we said earlier in the hour, Japanese Pharmaceutical Association Journal, not only calling for us to abandon statin cholesterol-lowering drugs, but finding out for us that fish oil works better than the statin drugs, and, of course, calling for a change in the direction towards fish oil, of all things. So,
well, you know, because you were mentioning DDT, if you go back and you study the whole story, and that gentleman you mentioned who used to take a tablespoon of that was G. Gordon Edwards. He's gone on, passed away, but I know when he was 80 years old, he was climbing the Matterhorn, so he was in pretty good shape despite the fact he used to always take a tablespoon full of DDT and eat it before he gave a talk on DDT to show how harmless it was. But the reason DDT was outlawed was not because it was making eggshells soft, because they simply took the calcium out of the diet of the birds so that the shells would be soft, and then they fed them DDT. When they put the calcium back in and fed them DDT, the eggshells were just as normal as they could be, or maybe even a little hardier. But the thing is that this was population control. Almost 100 million people have died, have been killed by outlawing DDT. They knew exactly what they were doing. It was the safest insecticide we'd ever had, and it still is. That's why they're not using it. That's why they've outlawed it here, so they can spray your vegetables and fruits with fluoride, which really is deadly and dramatically increases your fluoride levels. And, of course, the fluoride consumption influences your fertility. And, of course, it's, once again, about population control. And you can see how all of this cuts back to the fact that there really are just too many people in the world today, and they're going to decrease the numbers one means or another. And even if a 100 million die of malaria, most of them are black anyway, and they really don't care, because there's a terrible racist attitude among many of these people within the elite who are doing these terrible and vicious, horrible things that are happening to the world. And until you begin to study these things, as Bill has and as I have, and begin to analyze it, we have a wonderful talk called Planned Population Reduction. That's Planned Population Reduction. When we get back, we'll tell you a little bit more about that. Bill, we've got about 30 seconds before we go to a break. Do you want to say anything? I want you to stay through the break.
Well, certainly, we want everybody to keep listening to Radio Liberty because of these breakthrough stories that we're giving you. course, I hope that you understand how well documented they are.
And, of course, that's knowledgeofhealth.com. That's knowledgeofhealth.com or askbillsardi.com. Askbillsardi.com. Go there. Get the information. Check the facts out. It comes from valid medical journals. It's there. And then you need to get your doctor informed. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Bill, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Of course, we've been talking tonight about health by the numbers, how modern medicine has misled us into thinking that if our blood pressure numbers are good, if our cholesterol numbers look fine, if our PSA test is low, and if our bone density is in good shape, that we're healthy. And, of course, we find this is quite misleading. It's good for business, but it's not good for your health. We can't just be treating numbers. We got to be treating the patients and knowing that they're doing better. And, of course, please don't fall for this approach to looking at numbers and thinking those numbers move around and that you're a lot healthier. There's lots of flaws in those. We'll have our report, Health by the Numbers, up on the website here soon for you to see at Knowledge of Health. And, of course, we also talked about some of the medications, losing our memory and so on. They're putting us on a lot of medications that seem to interfere with our brain function. These are drugs like Lanoxin, which is a form of digoxin, or Lasix, a water pill, and so on. So many people are on these pills, and they don't realize that eventually it's having a mental impairment effect. So for many of us, we need to learn these lessons. We love to do the research and share it with you so that you, your family, your loved ones will be healthier. Please don't end up being a victim of this disease care system that's there. You'll need to put out a few dollars of your own money to stay healthy. I know they've got all our insurance money, but it will certainly pay off in the long run. And God wants us all to live long and productive lives, and, of course, that's our goal.
And, of course, really, vitamin C is so vitally important. Vitamin D is vitally important. Garlic compounds really do cut down on the incidence of infection. And certainly, selenium is an important thing. And fish oil, all of these things. And you'll learn so much as you go to Bill Sardi's website, askbillsardi.com or knowledgeofhealth.com. And you need to have the information. You need to help get that information out because we're responsible for our health. And if you look and see what the Centers for Disease Control, do you really feel that we really need to put our confidence in them? What is a direct result of their policies? There are 60 million Americans with a sexually transmitted viral disease. Those aren't my figures. That is the CDC's own figures. And, of course, I think we really need to let people understand they're going to have to look after themselves. They can't look to a government agency. Bill Sardi, thank you so much, very much for being with us again.
Thank you again, Dr. Stan.
Good night.
Night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and, of course, if you'd like to know more about the statin drugs, we do carry a book on the statin drugs. We do carry a four-tape set on statin drugs. And then, of course, on the matter of the DDT, we actually have a wonderful interview with Dr. G. Gordon Edwards. If you'd like to hear that, that's in the four-tape set on population control. And then we talked about something we have. It's called planned population reduction. It's a talk I gave maybe about a year ago to the Prophecy Club. And I think that it will give you an overview of what's really going on. Why would anybody advocate things that are not good for our health? Why would anybody propose things for our children that would be harmful for them? Because there are really people who have a different view of the world. They believe there are too many people in the world. They believe that an elite really should be running things. If you'd like to get the pages from Bertrand Russell's book, will be The Impact of Science on Society, why give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Of course, much of this is covered in my talk on the history of water fluoridation, and in the many of these documents are in my syllabus that goes with that, the hidden agenda. That's the hidden agenda, and of course the talk is on the history of water fluoridation. You have to understand that they're poisoning our children, and people say that could not be happening. Well, I would simply ask you to go to a website, not my website. It's NTEU280.org. 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 And, of course, that's the website of the unions that represent the 11 unions that represent the scientists and the engineers and the technicians there who work for the Environmental Protection Agency. And they are seriously concerned that we're poisoning the American people. Get their material. It's all there on the website. If you can't get it, of course, you can call us at 1-800-544-8927. Or you can certainly go to our website, radioliberty.com. My population control agenda monograph is up there. You can pull it down free of charge. That's the population control agenda monograph, where we actually outline the documentation for the fact that there really are people who would like to eliminate 90% of the world's population, and their statements are actually set in stone at the occult monument in Elberton, Georgia, called the American Stonehenge or the Georgia Guidestones, where they advocate maintaining the world population at 500 million in constant balance with nature. But of course, to do that, you're going to have to kill off over 90% of the world population. Could this really be true? Does that have anything to do with the things we're hearing? Oh, you shouldn't take vitamin D. Pardon me, vitamin C. You don't need it at all. Ladies and gentlemen, we don't produce vitamin C. Fruit bats, hamsters, and human beings don't produce vitamin C. They need it. Please go to our website at radioliberty.com. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for America, pray for revival, pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. We are on the front line of this battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. And believe me, Christian civilization is under attack today. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station that you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Now, we live in very, very strange times, and those of you who listen to our programs realize that we believe that there is a conscious effort to make people ill, and with many, many things, but one of them certainly is with genetically altered food. Now, some people will say, oh, look at the wonderful things we're doing. Look at how beautiful those ears of corn look today. Why, you don't even see any caterpillars in them like we used to, and that is true. And the reason you don't see them there is because they put something in every kernel of corn that'll kill the caterpillars. But what does it do when we eat it over a long period of time? What are the 20-year follow-up studies on human consumption of that or many of the other genetically modified crops today? Well, with us today is Jerry Guidetti from the Arc Institute, and she is a genetic engineer. She did doctoral work in genetic laboratories, and she can tell us a lot more about what we're doing to the food supply. But right now, of course, we're going to talk a little bit about the analysis of what's happening as far as the global pandemic is concerned. Jerry, you pick up the story.
Sure, Stan. Nice to be here again. What I wanted to point out is that one of your great listeners called me on the phone this past week and talked to me some about the bird flu issue and our discussions about it on the air. And he said, you know, Jerry, my friends that I talk to about bird flu have all heard bits and pieces of this story. And everyone, it seems, has a different belief about what it's really about. For example, he said, so many of my friends believe that this is the powers that be trying to instill fear because people under fear can be controlled. Or they're trying to get us to take bad vaccines. Or this is a conspiracy by a foreign government. Or it's bioterrorism. Or it's whatever. He says, and so when they dismiss this as some force of evil, they don't believe that it's something they have to worry about. He said, what do you think about that? And I said, you know, I'm so used to fielding these kinds of conspiracy theories, and I cannot knock anybody's beliefs down. All I can say is this. Whether you want to believe that it was caused by bioterrorism or by a government that release something accidentally, or, you know, our own government, or whatever your belief system, go ahead and believe it and take the attitude that it doesn't matter how it got here. It's here. Now, what are you going to do about it? You still have to deal with it. And if you look at what has happened just in the past 2 months with the bird flu story, and I'll give you a list when you come back from break, but if you look at what's happened, you realize this is now essentially around the world, with the exception of North and South America. It is everywhere, and folks have to understand that it's real, no matter what the cause, and that they may, in fact, even in America, even in Canada, even in Central America, they may have to deal with it.
Well, of course, it's certainly having a devastating effect on the people who are in the poultry business throughout the world. But we're going to be back here in just a moment. But if it's in the rest of the world, it's going to get here sooner or later. We'll be right back. Well, I guess this evening is Jerry Guidetti from the Arc Institute. Pick the story up there, Jerry.
Sure. I think we really do owe it to folks to listen to the list that is now developed for all of the countries with H5N1 now confirmed or suspected as of February 22nd. As a matter of fact, a couple of these have been updated. I've updated a few of these since February 22nd, but I think we'll go down the list so people understand. Take a look at your maps if you have one nearby. Austria, Azerbaijan, Belgium, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Bulgaria, Cambodia, China, Croatia, Cyprus, Egypt, France, Germany, Greece, Hungary, India, Indonesia, Iran, Iraq, Italy, Japan, Kazakhstan, Kuwait, Laos, Libya, Malaysia, Mongolia, Nigeria, and nine of the states within Nigeria now, Romania, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Slovakia, Slovenia, South Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, Turkey, the United Kingdom, which is Britain, Ukraine, Vietnam, and now suspected recently, Albania, Bulgaria, Chad, and Netherlands, Niger, Palestine, Poland, Serbia, and Montenegro, Sweden, and tested Algeria, the Czech Republic, Denmark, Ethiopia, Finland, Morocco, Portugal, Reunion Island, Spain, and Switzerland. Now, since you and I began talking, Stan, that list has grown enormously. We started out, don't forget, just talking about China, Vietnam, Indonesia, for example. But look at where it has marched just in the time you and I have been talking about it over the past several months. It has literally gone across Europe. And they're looking at it coming here into the United States this spring on the wings of birds. Now, that would be the high pathogenic HPAI, high pathogenic avian influenza H5N1 that is now mutated at Qinghai Lake, for example, where the gene sequences that cause it to be harmful, deadly to birds as well as being able to be transmitted to humans and to poultry and so on. We're looking for that variety to come over through Alaska. We've already increased greatly the numbers of monitors we have up in Alaska. So I would say to Michael, your listener, who we had a great discussion talking about this, he said, geez, Jerry, if you'd only tell people, they have to be concerned anyway.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Jerry Quinetti, and she was simply talking about one of our callers who had called her, named Michael. And of course, Jerry's statement is true. We've got to be concerned. This is not something we can ignore. There are many threats it faces. We certainly have to make preparations for any of these things, but there's a very real possibility that, I mean, this could certainly break out in the human population. Of course, the concern is, will it mutate so that it can go from person to person? It can infect people who get close contact with birds now. But what would happen if it suddenly became transmissible between humans? Because it's certainly highly transmissible among birds right now.
Right, and it's also transmissible human to human. The World Health Organization is calling it person to person to distinguish with that broadly transmissible human-to-human events. But we do have isolated cases of person-to-person transmission where those people have close contact to one another. Now, the question is, have they also had close contact with birds? Well, in some cases, we can absolutely say clearly that they have not had contact with birds, that the only place they could have caught it is from their loved one at home, someone they nursed, took care of, or so on. And what we're fearing now is that Indonesia, for example, has now reported, I believe it was 24 today, dead. Their fatalities are going up dramatically. China has reported, too, today, two more fatal human cases. They are now, China is saying, we could have a catastrophic explosion of bird flu with the remigration of birds back to China in the spring, and they are expecting, of course, given they have billions and billions of chickens all over China, that there is going to be human exposure, further opportunity for the mutation of the strain in chickens going into humans, and then further mutation so that it will get efficiently human to human as the 1918 pandemic was. And now the the big question is, how do we convince folks, like some of Michael's friends and like so many of the other folks that we talk to on the air and in person every day, Stan, how do we convince them that regardless of how this thing started in the very beginning, it's here, it has a life of its own. It's not being genetically modified, I can tell you that. It's not being changed. It's not being engineered to infect them individually. Any individual who would release one of these things out into the environment and then expect it to kill off selected groups doesn't know viruses. They mutate within minutes. There is no way you can control it. It's like letting a genie out of a bottle. Any organization, any entity, any political group who would think about trying to kill off populations would have to have a death wish themselves to release something like this. You can't even create a vaccine against it. That's why we're having trouble, because it changes so frequently. So, bottom line is, you have to take it seriously no matter what your belief system. And there is a discussion going on right now, well, many discussions at high levels of all governments on how to communicate this risk to populations, to people, in a way that is not going to cause panic. And that, unfortunately, is the $640,000 question. How do you tell people that something very awful is coming, that a novel virus has the potential to alter the face of the earth by killing off large numbers of humans and animals, birds included and so on? How do you communicate with that without them thinking that either you're telling them a line of baloney to control them, or that you have some other agenda? And what we come up with here in the United States, I think, was very succinctly summarized by a woman by the name of Madeline Drexler. She's a Boston-based journalist, and she authored a book called Secret Agents, The Menace of Emerging Infections. Now, she talks about why is it that we have 2 million Americans that could die in a flu pandemic. And scientists say that it's not just inevitable, but overdue. And then she says, in such an emergency, national leaders will need to be forthright and candid to gain our trust or risk chaos. She then goes on to point out that we have a situation here in the U.S. which is kind of jaded the way all of us think. We have a president who took us to war in Iraq, and many people believe that that war was unjustly entered. And maybe most people believe that. It was based on the fact that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. We find out that he didn't have it. And so people are looking at their leaders now with distrust. How can you trust anything that comes out of that man's mouth, you might hear them say. Well, then you get that same man who stands in the Rose Garden 4 months ago and says, it appears that we have the potential of a human pandemic coming, and we're going to have to use the military to quarantine off whole regions of the United States. And how better to control a pandemic than to use the military? Who is better suited? Well, you hear something like that and the hair stands up on the back of your neck, and you also don't want to believe him because of the history with the Iraqi war. Then you see the horrors happening in Iraq every day. You're getting very angry over that. And then you see the triple horror that happened in Katrina, where the federal government was not able to come to the rescue of 3 states worth of people, and you saw horrible suffering down there that goes on till today, and you say, well, they obviously must have had a plan there, an agenda, or they certainly aren't helping those people. And so you kind of, either you run out of compassion, or you run, the government has run out of credibility in your eyes, and so what you do is you kind of tuck it off in a place in your brain where you don't have to think about it very much, and you just ignore it, figuring it's going to go away. It's more lies. It's more of the same. And you go on with life. What folks have to realize is, unfortunately, despite that history for this administration and any other politicians who have failed us, is we are on our own. we are needing to take seriously the fact that we probably are next with this pandemic. It's already pandemic, meaning global epidemic, widely spread. It's already pandemic in birds, in wild birds, and then it moves into domestic birds. But it can become pandemic in humans tomorrow afternoon. We can get a plane arrive in L.A. Somebody steps off the plane with high fever and so on, and we have somebody arriving from, say, Indonesia or Vietnam or Thailand, and he or she is the index case of the first totally mutated one or two more genes needed to go to get the human-to-human transmissible form. So if that's the case, then we have to face the truth. And how do we communicate risk to folks, and how do we communicate the truth? We do it by telling them, this is going to hurt a lot. This is going to be bad. We don't have enough coffins to bury our loved ones. That at the meeting in Minnesota last week, they were teaching business leaders the basics of how to bury folks in your backyard. I know you don't want to hear this. I don't want to hear it. I really don't want to hear it. But history shows that if you tell people the truth, what might happen, so that they are prepared to accept it, and that preparedness attitude or that acceptance leads them to action to protect themselves and their families, well, then we have done something good for folks. But to not communicate that risk at all is unconscionable. I remember listening to the president that day, and what did he say? I think his exact words were something like, please be assured we're doing everything possible. And it was almost patronizing, because he couldn't possibly do, this government can't possibly do everything possible anymore. We're just about last on the list of governments. We're, last I heard, we were 26th on the list with Roche for getting Tamiflu, which is the antiviral that at least shows promise in lessening the symptoms, helping preventing the full-blown course of the disease so that we can save some lives. And yet we read in the press this week that his brother Jeb Bush down in Florida has decided to take the bull by the horns himself, and for the state of Florida, he is going to commit $38.5 million to buying Tamiflu, and he is negotiating directly with Roche for Tamiflu if he can get it for the citizens of Florida. Now that is unique, and it is really a red flag with respect to a governor making the decision that he'd better get on the ball and do this himself, because the federal government is not doing it for all of the people in this country. We have in storage in this country enough for about 4 million courses. However, we're looking at having to double those courses to get some control over this thing. So that means we really only have enough in this country for 2.5 million people. And if you read the government's own literature, you will find out that it is going to medical personnel, first responders, military, and Congress, and so on. World Health Organization has just said it's going to be more important to keep up the infrastructure, food delivery, water delivery, so on, medicines, regular pharmaceuticals, than it is going to be to save lives. So the best thing you and I can do, Stan, is put it out there that people really have to listen, and they really have to decide that this could happen, and make some calm preparations.
Well, what calm preparations would you suggest people make?
Sure. What you need to do is make sure that for all of your family members, you have a minimum of 1 gallon a day of water in storage, and you need to put away as much as you can for the long term.
In other words, basically, you're going to have to isolate yourself to keep away from people who have the disease. You're going to have to self-quarantine.
There is going to be self and forced quarantine, and the federal government has already warned us that we do not, cannot expect the cavalry.
Hold that thought right there. All right, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Jerry Guidetti, and of course Jerry is saying that if the unthinkable should happen and this bird flu should break out in our society, you cannot expect the cavalry to come. The cavalry, of course, is the government. And I will tell you, of course, the worst thing we could have would be the cavalry to come. Mm-hmm. They went into New Orleans. They kept out the people who wanted to come in and help, you know, with the airboats or with motorboats or with supplies or... The firemen who came from all across the country to help when they sent off to another city for a lecture on sexual harassment. The federal government, FEMA, did everything they could to complicate the situation and to create the chaos that we saw in New Orleans. And so if we do have a problem in America, do not look to the government. FEMA is Federal Emergency Management, and it's all about managing you. And it's not about helping you. It's not providing for you. It's about managing and control. And you saw what a great job they did down there. But they tell us we learned. We'll do better next time. I wouldn't give them a next time. I think that we have to look to looking after ourselves. Would you agree that?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, Peter Sandman, I don't know if you've read any of his work. You can look him and Google him on the Internet. Peter Sandman is how you spell it. This man specializes in risk communication. And as he said, what we need to do as a government, our government, should be saying, look, it's hard for us to be the ones to warn you. Some of you are thinking about Iraq, where we warned you and we were wrong. Some of you are thinking about Katrina, where we warned and we didn't respond well. Lots of you are thinking about the fact that we're going to take this issue seriously now. Why weren't we taking it seriously 2 years ago and gearing up properly? We come to this with a very imperfect record, but we've got to tell you about it anyhow. And it reminds me of times when I was going through college and graduate school. I was working as a phlebotomist in a laboratory, taking blood from people. I used to bleed rats all the time, so I used to get to bleed little children because, you know, I could find small veins. A terrible story. But there's a lesson here, and that is I did a lot of leukemia patients. And these were little baby kids, and it was the most painful, most horrible thing to have to do that. But I did find that when you had 2- and 3-year-olds, and they looked at you with fear in their eyes, and you told them, honey, this is going to hurt, but it's going to be over real fast, count with me, whatever. That's the same kind of attitude, I think, that we need to take with folks who aren't up to speed on this yet and say, look, this is going to hurt. It can hurt a lot, but we can prepare for it by taking care of our families now. And you can go to the government's own site. Why they haven't published these things and put them out in newspapers yet, I don't know, but you can go to pandemicflu.gov, pandemicflu.gov, and you'll get checklists for preparation for your family.
And in fact, I've been there, and I actually have that list set aside. I think it's an important list.
Yes.
And of course, Jerry's got some excellent lists,
yes,
too. But you need to stop and think about all the things that you would need. Now, they are saying, I mean, here in California, Maria Scriver, the governor's wife, has talked about going to the California site, beginning to make preparations. And everybody, I believe, in the listening audience tonight should take serious of making preparations. We don't know what's going to happen, but the preparation is far better than simply sitting around and doing nothing, because that would lead to chaos when something happens.
Right. And nobody's going to be bringing food.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Jerry, pick up the story there.
Sure. Don't count on anyone to bring you the things that you need. You're needing to think about how you can be 12 to 18 months self-reliant. Now that, you can just start laughing right now. Most people will. But that is the length of time it's going to take for a pandemic to complete its course, if history is any indication. And we have 3 of these a century, and some of them are real doozies, and they wipe out great portions of the Earth's population. Unfortunately, Stan, now we travel by jet and car and truck and so on. And if we transport this thing around and around and around quickly, it's probably going to last at least 12 months, if not longer. In the past, it's taken 12 to 18 months. There's even an argument that the 1918 may have started. 1916 and 1917 to 18 was its peak for a total of 2 to 3 years. Now, what does that mean? Well, the government at that time said, okay, the flu is over, you can send the kids back to school. And when they did, all of those children died. Unfortunately, we knew nothing about pandemics at that time, how they worked. Now we have studied them. We've been doing a crash course since 1997 when H5N1 first appeared in Hong Kong in humans. And we've done a crash course, and now we're beginning to understand how they work. So folks are needing to think about what it is that they would need to support themselves for a long term, not just a week, not 2 weeks, not 3 months, and so on. But please start out with a week's preparations. Start out with a month's preparations and slowly build up, even if you're buying nothing but rice, beans, flavorings, and oils to make the rice and beans more palatable, even if you start out that way, and water. But then also think about how you will take care of your loved ones at home by yourself, because hospitals will be closing as these waves go through. Please don't take my word for it. Read it anywhere at government websites, CDC, and so on. Hospitals will be overwhelmed within 24 to 48 hours after these hit. You will be asked not to go to hospitals anymore. Now, at the ARC Institute's website, that's ARC as in Noah's Ark, A-R-K, Institute.com, if you go to that website on that front page, that home page, you can scroll down and get several free manuals just by clicking the link. We've posted them up on pages on our site, so you can print these out. One of the most valuable is Dr. Grattan Woodson's manual for taking care of pandemic influenza at home. He is a professor at Emory Medical School. He teaches medicine. He said he puts this manual that he wrote out on the tables in his waiting room for his clients, because he's telling his patients that he will not be there for them, that he knows he will not be there for them, and they need to be able to take care of themselves in their homes. I think he published this, oh, maybe 9-10 months ago it's been out there, and he has graciously allowed people to put it up on the internet to give away free, and we do the same thing. And so look for it. It's Dr. Grattan, G-R-A-T-A-N, Woodson, W-O-O-D-S-O-N. It's on the ARC Institute's website on the front page. You can also Google his name and come up with it. And take that, print it out. It's 37 pages long. And then we ask that anyone who has the financial resources to be able to print it out, print out as many copies as you can afford, and printing is expensive these days, photocopying. But if you could even afford to make 2-3 copies, please give a copy to those in your neighborhood or in your family who don't have a computer, cannot access it. And by all means, call the ARC Institute and tell us if you don't have access to it, and we'll see about making a copy for you and sending it to you, because we want everyone to have it. We don't want money to be an issue. We don't want need to be an issue, or folks who are shut in, can't get out. There are such great tips in here, for example, how to make up a salt and sugar solution at home very simply to give to your loved ones or to yourself to keep dehydration from killing you with this very bad, bad flu.
All right. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment or two with Jerry Guidetti of the ARC Institute. And, of course, Jerry is a genetic engineer, and he certainly understands a great deal about the problems we face today. And we'll be talking, of course, later in the program about some of the other things that are happening as far as genetically engineered food is concerned. And, of course, when we get back in just a moment or two, we'll tell you how to get hold of Jerry and get the information that she has. And, of course, perhaps you'll even be interested in getting the seeds that she actually produces. The heirloom seeds, which, of course, is not genetically engineered, so that you can have a good, safe supply of food readily available. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Jerry Guidetti. Jerry, go ahead with the story.
Sure. Well, as you know, and it's probably really important that we shift gears because we do have so much to tell folks about the Terminator technology, and certainly it's not good news again. For those of your listeners who have not heard us talking before, the ARC Institute began due to my concern about the genetic modification of our food supply, but most importantly, of the seeds that make it possible for us to raise food. As a genetic engineer, as a person who was working at the time on soybeans, for example, genetically engineering soybean seeds in, soybean cells in tissue culture, I became very concerned about this exceedingly powerful science that had the ability to change the very nature of the seeds that we were going to grow. And I began to wonder, my gosh, we are inserting these genes, and I did it, please believe me, I did it, many, many different kinds of genes into these cells. And I'm wondering, what will the effects be on human beings? When are we testing that? And of course we're not. We're going at it willy-nilly because we have tunnel vision, and we're looking at the great benefits of the particular changes that we're making in these cells. And in fact, we're not looking at the broader, bigger picture. Well, I always was a very big picture biologist, and it concerned me. So giving you that background, I then became very concerned about the entire security of the global food supply, because the changes I saw coming actually made that food supply less secure because we were eliminating biodiversity, the thing that makes it possible for natural evolution among all of nature's plants to occur. And we did that because we were improving, and I put that in quotations, we were improving crops in order to get certain effects, for example, disease resistance, or higher protein, or could stand drought longer, or, you know, whatever. These were all great, noble goals. However, it became apparent to companies that were hiring us genetic engineers that, wow, we could put genes in that are proprietary, that only belong to us, and then we could patent those life forms, those seeds. We can patent soybeans. We could patent corn because we have our gene in it. And sure enough, that's exactly what they began to do. So what I began to see was that where we had great biodiversity...
Hold that thought right there, Jerry. Be back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Jerry Guidetti of the ARC Institute, who, of course, was a genetic engineer and worked in genetic engineering for many years. But before we get back to that, I want you to get your telephone number. I want you to get your website out for our listeners.
Sure. Sure. The website is ARK, A-R-K, I-N-S-T-I-T-U-T-E.
ARK Institute.
ArkInstitute.com. You'd be surprised how many people ask me to spell that on the phone, so I'm used to it.
Okay.
All right. ArkInstitute.com. 1-800-255-1912. 1-800-255-1912. And so, yes, we are concerned about the disappearance of all of the native seeds, the heirloom seeds, the unadulterated, non-genetically engineered seeds. And you and I have talked before about 1998, when our own U.S. Department of Agriculture joined up with Delta and Pine Seed Land Seed Company, and they were basically into cotton. And these folks, you know, using our tax dollars, developed a patent called Control of Plant Gene Expression. And I read that in 1998, and I was wondering, what the heck is this about, controlling plant gene expression? That's a very broad stroke to control plant gene expression. Sure enough, it was just that. What it was a very broad, generic technology where we, the people, USDA, found a way to implant genetic sequences that we have now dubbed the Terminator, that made it possible for a plant that is maturing its own vegetables to kill its own seed embryos just at the point of maturity of that embryo by releasing a toxin, something toxic to that embryo to kill it. And the embryo dying, the baby inside the seed dying, that seed would no longer be able to grow. It was sterile. It had killed the embryo, literally. Well, turns out the technology was so broad in scope that it was designed to be used in just about any seeding plant. All they had to do was use a similar kind of gene sequence, implant it in the laboratory, and then grow out seeds from this, and it's a complicated procedure, but you get seeds out of it eventually, and then sell these seeds, and farmers can grow the corn, and the corn grows up, or the beans, or, you know, name your vegetable, grow it up, and then as the thing matures, the embryo dies, and guess what? Folks are no longer able to save seed to grow their crops next year. So where are you going to get it? You'll have to go back to the same company or to another company doing the same thing, and you'll have to buy your seed again. And over and over and over again. Now, that does two things. One, it takes out of the hands of people the ability to feed themselves and makes them completely dependent on a corporation who controls the seed to grow their food. And the second thing it does is it deprives all peoples of keeping their own seed or using their own seed, which was the biodiversity or the ability to keep the genes, the God-given genes, the naturally evolved genes down through eons of life on this planet, because the companies are not going to grow all of those varieties. They're going to focus on what? Let's just use for, because it's a common name, and this is not an engineered tomato to my knowledge, let's just say Big Boy Tomato, okay? A company like Burpee's Big Boy, might focus on just Burpee's Big Boy and a handful of other tomatoes, okay? Well, these genetically engineered seeds by these other companies would certainly not include 5,000 varieties of wheat, 10,000 varieties of corn, hundreds of thousands of varieties of peppers and tomatoes and eggplants and so on. They'll focus on 5 or 10 that they've done the genetic engineering on, that they've got control over, and so on. Now, what happens when a massive plant disease goes around the globe? As it always does. This is nature. A new fungus evolves, a new bacterium. You want to talk about agroterrorism, bioterrorism? That's it. Somebody could develop a fungus that could attack corn. And they only have to focus on a few varieties of corn because that's all that's being grown. Whereas nature's own mix of genes is rich in diversity. And the peoples of the earth hold those seeds in their hands right now. As a matter of fact, 1.3 billion people on the planet feed themselves every day only with the seeds that they've saved from last year. Now, I wrote the first non-scientific article. By non-scientific, I wrote it for lay audiences in 1998. You can find that original article on the Ark Institute's website under the food supply updates. Read that article. That article went around the world, went into all different countries in many different languages, and I heard from groups all around the world for years after that went out, because finally the common person began to see and read in their own languages that there was a threat to their own survival by corporations, a handful of corporations, a handful of men who controlled or hoped to control much of the global food supply and seed supply. And at that time, the uproar was so great that several countries reversed the patents that had already been granted for things like soybeans, for example. And there was a hue and a clamor all over, so that Europe said they will not accept genetically modified seeds. And it went on and on, and we here in the United States, unfortunately, have been getting more and more and more of it out in our fields, and we have been pushing it on the rest of the world. In fact, USDA said they hope to get it in 78 countries.
Now, of course, is this Terminator or is this the other thing?
This is all of them, but Terminator in particular was the one that was pushed. We now own three Terminator technology type technologies. These are technically called GURTS, G-U-R-T-S, Genetic Use Restriction Technologies. And it says it all. Basically, if you can't control people who want to take your seed and grow it out and then grow it themselves next year so that they have to come back to you for seed, you can't control it. Why not program it right into the seed itself so that they can't do that? So it's genetic use restriction by genetically engineering the seed. So a few years ago, well, first of all, the UN had agreed that there was a moratorium. It was a de facto moratorium on sterile seed technologies. It would so hurt the peoples of the world that the UN passed a resolution. It's a moratorium. We will not do it. Now, the first company, Monsanto, who bought the Terminator from Delta Pine Land, they said that they will not commercialize the Terminator. They took out, I remember, a full-page Wall Street Journal ad that they took out saying that they weren't going to do that. But at any rate, they decided they wouldn't because the backlash against their company was enormous, especially all of Europe. They just said no way, and Asian countries and so on. So what do we have happen on February 21st, what was that, a week ago? 6 days ago. Monsanto, the world's largest seed and agrobiotech company, made a public promise in 1999 not to commercialize Terminator technology, plants that are genetically engineered to produce sterile seeds. Now Monsanto says it may develop or use the so-called suicide seeds after all. The revised pledge from Monsanto now suggests that it will use Terminator seeds in non-food crops and does not rule out other uses of the Terminator in the future. Their modified stance comes to light as the biotech and seed industry confront peasant and farmer movements, indigenous peoples, and their allies in an escalating battle at the United Nations over the future of Terminator. Now, let me summarize by saying there are three countries that are involved in trying to get this Terminator commercialized with us, the United States. And that is, now we've talked Australia, New Zealand, and Canada into helping us to literally force this down the throats of all the Europeans, and they're still up in arms.
But of course, the difficulty with this is that if you control the seeds, you control the food, you control the world, you control the people. And what would happen if you suddenly just did not provide the seeds for the people? Once you've taken away the ability of people to save their own seeds and to utilize those, then you're in real trouble. And they are going to use the power of government to force this. The people of Europe do not want this. The governments there don't want it. So now they've got the World Trade Organization saying, yeah, well, we're a nation, we're a world of laws, we pass the laws, you've got to use this, even though it's never been proved to be safe. And, of course, we're not necessarily talking about the Terminator. We don't know what that is. Are there any long-term health studies done with the Terminator technology?
No long-term studies. No studies have been done. As a matter of fact, I released the information here, about a month ago, on the Russian studies, the Russian Institute of Science, that is just going to be putting this out in their journal, a prestigious science journal, that we now have pregnant rats who eat genetically modified seeds were actually giving birth to babies that died early after birth, very, very young, and they were defective. Then we had another rat study that was done on, it was on BT corn, and Bacillus thuringiensis corn, and that one ended up with rats with defects, kidney malformations, irregular blood composition, and sickness, and so on. And, you know, these studies could be read. They were glossed over. It's amazing how you can get scientists. I'm embarrassed to say I'm a scientist when I read some of these studies, because some of them are so obviously tainted. It's not the way a scientist analyzes results. When you see conclusions that are written to gloss over the abnormalities in the animals instead of being truthful about it, showing that they were statistically significant, that they were substantial, and that they only occurred in the group that had, the experimental group that had the genetic events in their cornmeal that they fed them. How could you do this as a scientist? As a matter of fact, I have been offered contracts before where it actually did ask you, would you be willing to change data, da-da-da-da-da-da. I couldn't believe my eyes. Could not believe my eyes as a young woman when I saw this. And, of course, I said no, handed them back the contract. That's not what we're trained to do. And there are very few people who will do that. But unfortunately, when you read some of this data, I mean, maybe they go home and sleep at night and say that they can put their name on it, sign the bottom of this thing and say that that's what they saw in the data. You know, that's not what's in the data. When you have these results, you have to be honest about them. So, anyway, bottom line is, yes, we are, here we are with all of these negative problems in terms of the global opinion of our leaders, this country. There are an awful lot of people who don't like us, and at the same time, we're out there trying to force even down the throats of our friends in Europe, people who trusted us, who work with us, our allies. We're trying to make their populace swallow this food, swallow these technologies, forcing them to take them. You know, these little sweetheart deals that happen at the UN, that happen at these biodiversity conferences and so on, these sweetheart deals that have huge implications for the ability for people to feed themselves. Bottom line is we are encouraging and have been encouraging since 1998, but now more than ever, with bird flu on the horizon, with the potential that you may see a changed world if a pandemic happens. If the human pandemic happens, we can go back 100 years. You need to collect seed. You need to collect non-hybrid, non-genetically engineered seed. You don't have to get it all from the Ark Institute. There are lots of other varieties out there, lots of other specialty old seeds and so on, if you hunt for them. But we have a collection. You could go to the Ark Institute's website, or you can call the 800 number and get these seeds. And even if you don't plant them this year or just plant a few this year, you'll find instructions for freezing them in your freezer, keeping them long term. And you don't have to have a freezer. You can put them in the refrigerator using the same instructions. Just don't put them in cardboard boxes or paper envelopes. They'll get moldy in there. Okay, you definitely want to keep them dry. Store them, keep them for the long term. Begin to grow some of them out, even if you just practice with one kind of seed like green beans or tomato plants and so on. But in the event of an emergency, you have something better than gold. You have something with the ability to feed not only yourself, but even your whole community, and you can save the seeds from year to year to year to feed yourself and others. And frankly, Stan, that's what food security is. That's what our ancestors did. That's the way humans have survived on this planet. And that's what this short, brief spot, speck of time, of people on the planet have plans to reverse, to end the ability of the human race to feed itself. And this is wrong. This is very wrong.
I share your concern. These corporations just really want to take away the ability to people to feed themselves, and they're using the World Trade Organization to force their genetically modified food on the rest of the world. So, once again, let's get your website out and your telephone number, Jerry, so people would know how to get hold of you and get hold of those heirloom seeds.
Yes, it's ARK, A-R-K, Institute.com. And the number is 1-800-255-1912. Sometimes folks like to write instead, and I'll give you a P.O. box number and address for the ARK Institute, too, because I get calls about that. What's your address? The ARK, A-R-K Institute, P.O. box 1721, 1721, Gold Beach, Oregon. OR 97444.
And of course, Gold Beach is one of the prettiest parts of Oregon, right out there along the coast, isn't it?
Yes, it sure is. It's up here on the coast, and it's raining like the dickens this winter. I'll tell you what, we had 31 inches of rain in January alone, and it's raining again now. So we've had lots of rain, even though we have a very moderate climate. I was looking forward to being able to grow out our test gardens this winter for some of our winter crops. We haven't been able to do that because of the heavy rains. We've had to put that off. I'm hoping to be able to get some of these test seeds for the Ark Institute's seed collection in the ground in the next couple of weeks. And then we'll have even more to offer next year.
All right, fine. Well, our guest, of course, has been Jerry Guidetti from the Ark Institute. And we're talking about the thought of being prepared. Do you know how to be prepared? What would you do if suddenly you couldn't go down to the local grocery store and buy the fruits and vegetables you're used to? Well, certainly you want to get hold of Jerry. She's got a lot of great, great information. And we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program here at Radio Liberty. But I should mention that Jerry does help Radio Liberty. Well, Jerry, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
3 minutes. Well, I would have to ask everybody to think in terms of the way their grandparents used to live. We never had homes in those days that didn't have a ready supply of food and a little garden out back and access to well water. Well, we don't all have well water anymore, but our government officials are telling us, those who have been honest, like Dr. Michael Osterholm at CIDRAP, and that's CIDRAP.com. Go there, read his article, CIDRAP.com. You will find that we are totally unprepared as a country. That's the truth that hurts. And you will be on your own. Your community will be on your own. Michael Levitt is going around the country, and he's telling states to get ready to take care of themselves. You are your brother's keeper. You're your own keeper and your brother's keeper. Take care of yourself. Think about how you're going to help your neighbor. And all together, we might be able to keep the death rate, if this pandemic occurs, down below the expected 2 million or more here in the United States. I would encourage everybody to look at their water supply. They're thinking, with 30 to 50% of people out of work, electric may go down sporadically. Water may go down. We don't have enough chlorine to chlorinate the water here in this country. So you might have impure water supplies. Get yourself a water filter. Take care of yourself and your family and think in terms of long-term care, even taking care of your children at home. Government is recommending getting books to homeschool your children for extended periods of time because schools will be closed. You have to think this way. Read the book, The Great Influenza by John Barry. That's a good book to read. You can get that on Amazon. You can get it in your bookstore, The Great Influenza by John Barry. Read that. You'll have a much better picture of what life was like in the United States in 1918.
Because one of the interesting things about that was the Surgeon General of the Army knew what needed to be done,
yes,
and the federal government refused, yes, to do it. The Department of the Army refused to do it. Instead of isolating the people and quarantining them, and they put them on troop ships and spread this disease all over the world.
Over the world, absolutely.
It's an amazing, amazing story. Well, Jerry, thank you so very much for being with us. And our closing thought is, ladies and gentlemen, be prepared. We don't know what the future holds, but we're moving into very uncertain times. And so people are going to have to make preparations for themselves physically and certainly spiritually. So God bless you, Jerry. We'll look forward to talking to you later.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. Okay, fine. Well, that was Jerry Guidetti from the Ark Institute, and certainly her message is a very, very important one at this time. We don't know what the future holds, but make your preparations accordingly. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. We're really dependent on those of you who hear our programs to help us as we reach out across America. 5 hours every day. Our evening program now is going to be heard on about 30 different stations, which is an expensive proposition. We buy time on radio stations, our afternoon program, our early morning program. We do programs on about 4 or 5 different networks, the American Freedom Network, the Genesis Network, the Radio Liberty Network, the Christian Network, and, of course, Republican Network. And we're on all sorts of Internet, shortwaves, satellites. Please go to our website, RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. You can hear our programs there. You can pull them down on MP3 or the archive programs. You can hear them live. And we don't charge you to listen to our programs. But, of course, we hope that you will appreciate our effort, because we want you to get the information and help us disseminate it out across America. We do hope that many of you will want to get the material we have on. We have an excellent book on genetically modified foods. It's called Seeds of Deception. We have my talk on the planned population control. I really think it's probably one of the most important talks I've ever given. And a wonderful new DVD put out by our good friend Chris Pinto. It's entitled The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. And it goes into the occult background of certain people who were here at the same time the Christians arrived in America, or shortly thereafter. Men came from a secret society in Great Britain called the Rosicrucians. And their job was to bring about the new order of the ages and to use America to bring about a new, the lost Atlantis that had been written about in Plato's dialogues. And it's, if you understand that there have been two forces at work in America, one the Christian and the other the occult. And at one time the Christian influence was predominant. Today the occult influence is predominant, and their goal is to bring about a world government and a one world religion with the destruction of Christianity. And behind everything that is going on today are secret societies, a secret movement, and a secret agenda. And, of course, America is moving rapidly into World War III, I believe. Without any question, we will soon be at war with Iran and with Syria. If you read Seymour Hersh's recent article, I think it was early in February in the New Yorker, he talks about how in Washington, D.C., it's a foregone conclusion. We're going to war with Syria and Iran, but everybody thinks it's just going to be, just a little short war, maybe a couple of weeks, and then it'll be over. And ladies and gentlemen, if you think that, you'd have never studied the history of the wars of this last century. And I very much fear that that if we attack Iran, as we are planning to do, Iran will retaliate. And if we attack Iran, we will mobilize the entire Islamic world against the United States, and we will see a clash of civilizations unparalleled since the time of the Great Crusades back in the 11 and 1200s. We are living in dangerous and perilous times. And so we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.